From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we continue Blues Week with three great rhythm and blues performers, singers Ruth Brown, the late Laverne Baker, and Etta James.
You thought you hadn't found a good girl, one to love you and give you the world. Now you find that you've been misused. Talk to me, I'll do what you choose. I want you to tell mama.
Etta James made her name in the 60s with hits like Tell Mama and At Last. We also hear interviews with Ruth Brown and the late Laverne Baker, who were among Atlantic Records' big hitmakers in the 50s. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Maryland teenager Samuel Scheinbein pleaded guilty in an Israeli courtroom to the murder of an acquaintance after successfully fighting extradition back to the U.S. Scheinbein admitted he strangled Alfredo Teo, then dismembered his body and set it on fire. NPR's Carol Van Dam reports.
19-year-old Samuel Scheinbein claimed Israeli citizenship through his father, though he never lived in Israel. He is to be sentenced to 24 years in an Israeli jail. He could go free in 14 years. Montgomery County State's Attorney Doug Gansler says the plea bargain is too lenient.
He should have been adjudicated here in the United States and held accountable here in the United States. Had that occurred, given the mountain of evidence that we had, he would have undoubtedly spent the rest of his life behind bars. As it is, under the Israeli system, he will be a free man roaming the streets of Israel, probably at the age of 33.
Pearl Bassan, who works at a Maryland synagogue, is outraged.
He's a sick young man who mutilated a body. He didn't just shoot somebody. Who said he won't do it again?
The plea bargain will likely be approved by an Israeli judge. Carol Van Dam, NPR News, Washington.
Firefighters in Southern California are hoping that lower temperatures and higher humidity will help them stop the spread of a huge wildfire in the San Bernardino National Forest. So far, the fire has blackened more than 60,000 acres of woodland and brush. Firefighters set fires of their own to clear a buffer zone between the blaze and resort areas. Officials say they have about 35% of the fire contained. Firefighters are trying to contain a half dozen other big wildfires in Montana, Utah, and Idaho. It's past midnight in Israel, where Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is meeting with Prime Minister Ehud Barak. The discussion comes as Israelis and Palestinians failed to clinch an expected peace deal. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Secretary Albright delayed her scheduled departure from Egypt for several hours to meet with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Arafat came to Egypt for a planned signing ceremony today on implementing the American-brokered Y River Peace Accord. Secretary Albright had said she did not want to get involved in mediating between the Israelis and Palestinians, but it seems that she will do so. The sticking point is the number of Palestinian prisoners that Israel will release. Secretary Albright spends tomorrow in Israel and the West Bank and flies to Damascus Saturday. She also hopes to revive stalled Israeli-Syrian peace talks. Israeli and Palestinian officials say there could still be a signing ceremony either tomorrow in Egypt or Saturday night in Gaza. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 94 points to close at 10,843. Declines led advances by 5-2 in moderate trading. This is NPR News from Washington. President and Mrs. Clinton have signed a contract to buy a 5-bedroom house in the New York City suburb of Chappaqua. The Clintons will pay $1.7 million for the house, which sits on an acre of land. The property would establish New York residence for Mrs. Clinton if she decides to run for the U.S. Senate. The house still must be approved by the Secret Service for security issues. Negotiations to end the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo stalled today over who will represent the main rebel group on two commissions. Ishbel Matheson reports from Lusaka, Zambia.
On Tuesday, the main rebel group, the Rally for Congolese Democracy, signed up to the Lusaka Peace Accord. But within hours, a dispute had broken out about which faction of the RCD should be represented on two key commissions responsible for implementing the ceasefire. The leadership wrangle within the rebel group has seriously hindered the progress towards peace in the DRC. The six African nations involved in the conflict agreed a truce at the beginning of July. But the RCD refused to endorse a peace agreement because the two factions couldn't agree on their leader. The peace process is now paralyzed until the rebel group agrees on its delegates to the military and political commissions. The only optimistic sign is that both sides say their forces on the ground in the DRC are observing the ceasefire. For NPR, I'm Ishbel Matheson in Lusaka.
The productivity of American workers grew more slowly in the second quarter while labor costs rose. The Labor Department said that after growing by 3.6% in the first quarter, productivity growth slowed to just 0.6% from April through June. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is battling a cold this week. Her voice has lowered to a sultry whisper. Not a bad voice for blues singing. But today we made her stay home and rest up. I'm Barbara Bogave. This is Blues Week on Fresh Air, and today we go to our archives for interviews with three great rhythm and blues singers, Ruth Brown, the late Laverne Baker, and our first guest, Etta James. Etta James is an R&B veteran. She got her start at the age of 15 when she was discovered by Johnny Otis and began performing with his traveling R&B review. By age 17, she had her first hit, Roll With Me Henry, an answer song to Hank Ballard's Work With Me Annie. After establishing herself as a rhythm and blues star in the late 50s and early 60s, her career was eclipsed by changes in pop music. But in 1993, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And her recent recordings have paid tribute to the great jazz singers Dinah Washington, Sarah Vaughan, Carmen McRae, and Billie Holiday.
The very thought of you, and I forget to do, the little ordinary things everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of daydream. I'm happy as a queen, but foolish though it may seem to me, that's everything. The mere idea of you.
That's Etta James singing The Very Thought of You. Terry spoke with her in 1994 and asked her why she wanted to record Billie Holiday songs.
Well, I thought that since I grew up and I did my teenage years in San Francisco, and my mother was such a Billie Holiday and jazz fan, mostly Billie Holiday, and I kind of, all along, I said, what, jazz? You know, so to me, as a young kid, that was like, it was too disciplined, it was too confining, at least that's the way I thought. And I thought you had to be really, really cool and had to be bourgeois, you know, to do that. And I didn't want to do that. I mean, I was a sloppy kid with tattoos all over. I wanted to be just wild. I think it took me maturing.
Now, let me ask you this. You grew up in a foster home. I think when your mother had you, she was 14 years old.
Right, she was a kid. And, you know, I had feelings about all that kind of stuff for years, and I went to therapy and all about it. But then as I got older, I realized that she really did the best for me. She put me in a lovely home. The people were, you know, lovely to me. They never said that they were my real parents. I mean, I always knew I had this good-looking, you know, high-stepping mom, and she was, like, only 14 years older than me, and so she did the best for me, because if she had tried to take me with her, she was just a child, what would she have done with me? Would I have been singing today? Would I have been anything, you know?
What was your foster family like?
They were lovely. They were older people, and they had property, and they lived in the east side, lower east side of Los Angeles, and my grandmother was a church lady, and they believed in You know, they gave me singing lessons at 5. And
So when you were singing in the church choir, did your grandmother or anyone else in the family get upset if on your own time you sang blues or any kind of secular music?
No, because my grandmother died when I was 12. So I sing gospel music from 5 until 12. And so my grandmother, she wasn't one of those kind of people, because I was already the prodigy child of the church. And, you know, and I did nothing but, and I loved church. I went to Bible camp, and I was a little Christian girl. And until my grandmother passed away at 12, that is when my mother came to get me. Because I had nothing but my grandfather there in the house, and my grandmother, my mother wanted me to be with her. And she came the day of the funeral to pick me up, to take me back to San Francisco. So that's at San Francisco. Oh, I was listening to little stuff on the sly, but I wasn't interested in secular music. But when once I got to San Francisco, I grew horns and a tail. And I really turned into, you know, the real street kid. I was kind of like a runaway, but I had a mother, you know what I mean? And I had a place to stay.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to play one of your rhythm and blues recordings that has a very gospel sound to it. Now, I want to play Something's Got a Hold on Me from 1961. Do you think of this as having a gospel sound?
Matter of fact, it is a gospel song. We wrote that song, and we adapted it from a gospel song. And the gospel song was Something's Got a Hold on Me, It Must Be the Lord.
And in your song, it must be love.
It must be love, right, right. Now, don't get me, because I'm not the one who decided to, but I was one of the writers. I just kind of said, okay, well, let's go, rock and roll.
This is Etta James, recorded in 1961.
Sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah, yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before, no, no, yeah. I just want to tell you right now that ooh, I believe, I really do believe that something's got a hold on me, yeah.
Oh, it must be love.
Oh, something's got a hold on me right now, child.
Oh, it must be love.
Let me tell you now, I've got a feeling, I feel so strange. Everything about me seems to have changed. Step by step, I got a brand new walk. I even sound sweeter when I talk. I said, oh.
It wasn't too long after you moved in with your mother that you actually went on the road. I mean, Johnny Otis, who had a now famous rhythm and blues touring review, got you into the show. He discovered you. But how did you audition for him? How did you find him, or he find you?
Well, kind of, yeah, I think it was kind of a little bit of both, really. But he really found me, because at that time, my mother, I had ran away from home. And I went and I stayed with two girls, one named Abby and Jean, who later became the Peaches. You know, it used to be Etta James and the Peaches. And we had wrote an answer to the song Work With Me, Annie.
The Hank Ballard record.
Right. So during those days, you know, everybody would make an answer. You'd said, Work With Me, Annie. Then we'd said, Roll With Me, Henry. And so one night, the young girl and myself, we were the same age. I think we were both like 16, and the older sister was like 24. And she went out to a dance in the Fillmore District, which was, you know, a heavy drag district of San Francisco. She went to see the Johnny Otis Band. And she was there because we couldn't go, and we didn't want to go anyway. We were, like, you know, different from her. We weren't, like, she was kind of like a groupie kind of a chick.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of, like, scared, you know, to do that. So all of a sudden, we got a call that night, and it was Abby calling us back to say, listen, guess who I'm with? I'm with Johnny Otis. And we go, oh, Johnny Otis. And he said, yeah, Johnny, I told him that we have a girl group, and he says he wants to hear us. And I said, yeah, right. How does he want to hear us? We're out there in the project in the boonies, right? And she says, oh, he's at the hotel there and all the band and everything. And myself and the girl looked at each other and said, yeah, right. Now we're 15-year-olds and we're going to go to the hotel with the band and Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis was like about a 34, 35-year-old man. So we said, oh, no, that's all right. That's all right. We'll cool that and everything. So Johnny Otis snatched the phone from her. And it was Johnny Otis. You know, we heard that voice, you know. And he said, hi, how you doing? And we said, oh, we're doing all right. He says, I hear you guys got a great group. I hear you got a song, a couple of songs, and I'd like to hear you. And he says, how about catching a cab? I'll pay the cab fare, and I'll meet you out front. And I said, oh, no, now this is getting heavy. This older man is going to, you know, send us in a cab. So we said, okay, let's go on. John, he sounded pretty sincere. And he said, don't worry, nobody's going to bother. He says, okay. So we got up and got dressed, got in the cab, and went down there. Sure enough, as we pulled up, we saw this tall man. You know, we'd all seen pictures of Johnny Otis with the nice hair, and he looked like a tall, kind of like a Creole man with a nice mustache and a beard, and he had, you know, and the nice pompadour hair. And he was standing there all stately, and he had two or three more guys with him. One guy was his manager, was a much older man. And when we got there, he said, oh, I'm glad to see you, and come on up and let's hear you. So we went upstairs to his room and we sang How Deep Is the Ocean and For All We Know and Street of Dreams.
So you auditioned for Johnny Otis. He liked your singing, I suppose,
right,
and invited you to go on the tour, but you were still a minor. Did you have to get your mother's permission?
Well, that was a trick there. My mother, I knew my mother wasn't going to let me go. But I told him, he says, how old are you? I said, 18, which he knew that was a lie. And he says, well, you know what? I would like to take you guys to Los Angeles tomorrow to make a record. And he says, can I speak with your mother? I said, no, I can't find her right now. She's working. And he says, well, can you go home and get permission from your mother, get something in writing stating that you can travel, and give me your mother's address and phone number and all this stuff, and saying that you can travel and you're allowed to travel with me, and have her to sign it and date it. I said, oh, yeah, I can do that. So sure enough, that's what I did. I went home. I wrote the note.
Oh, I see. I see.
And I brought the note back with a tiny little bag, a little plastic bag or something with some clothes in it. And myself and the two girls got on Johnny's bus and we split to L.A.
So why don't we hear the first song that you recorded? And this was the first song recorded after going on the road with Johnny Otis. And it's Roll With Me, Henry, also called Wallflower.
And called Dance With Me, Henry.
Called Dance With Me, Henry, also. And this is Etta James.
Hey, baby, what do I have to do to make you love me too?
You got to roll with me, Henry.
All right, baby.
Roll with me, Henry.
Don't mean maybe.
Roll.
After you recorded this, Georgia Gibbs did a cover recording of this called "Dance with Me, Henry," and
right.
was that supposed to be the tamer version?
Yeah. Well, you know, during those days, you weren't allowed to say "roll," because "roll" was like a vulgar word. You know what I mean? Think about it. They would probably burn Prince at the stake. Right? But you couldn't say "roll." So rather than they banned my record from the air. And what happened, what we had to do was sell it underground, and not only that, change the title to Wallflower. And then when Georgia Gibbs did it, she just made the Dance With Me, Henry, so that, you know, all the kids could go buy it and, you know, take it home and, you know, listen to it.
We're listening to an interview Terry Gross recorded in 1994 with singer Etta James. She has a new recording called Heart of a Woman. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with singer Etta James.
At some point in your career, you started dressing in evening gowns for performances and dyeing your hair blonde. Tell me how you created that onstage image for yourself.
I think probably by me being so young, and I was oversized like I am now, but I mean, I had a real nice figure and I was tall. And I remember this singer, Joyce Bryant. She was a black singer. And I always admired her. And I had two role models. I liked Joyce Bryant because she wore fishtail gowns, sequin fishtail gowns, and she was black. And she had the nerve to wear platinum hair. And then I also loved Jane Mansfield because Jane Mansfield had the blonde hair and had the, like, the poochy lips and the mole and all this. So I think what I did was kind of combined. My mother had bleached my hair carrot red at one point, and then I said, well, maybe that's not flamboyant enough. So I just kind of went into Detroit one day, and one of the fellas over there said, oh, Miss James, oh, why, you would probably look fabulous with platinum hair. So he bleached my hair blonde, and it looked good, and So then I started, what I was doing was trying to be a glamour girl because I had been a tomboy most of the time and I wanted to look grown. You know, I wanted to wear tall, high heel shoes and fishtail gowns and big long rhinestone earrings, you know.
So how long did you dye your hair?
For how long?
Yeah.
I think, well, most of my career, it was blonde, platinum blonde all the way, I would think, up into the 70s, maybe the 72 and 73, something like that.
And why'd you stop?
Well, I think things had changed. I know things had changed. And my career wasn't happening. And I didn't think that I needed to be that, you know, that to attract that much attention. Another thing, I was on drugs at that time, and I think I really wanted a low profile.
Hmm. Wait, was it difficult for you to give up drugs?
Not when I got down to, you know, I'd given it up many a time. You know, mm-hmm. I'd kicked my habits many a time. But when I went in 1974, I gave heroin up. I was on methadone for maybe 3 or 4 years before that. So I had a couple of things to give up.
Was it hard to make a comeback after you stopped using?
No, not really, because when I stopped using, I wasn't the kind that went around and wanted people to pat me on the back about it. It's just that I just picked up the ball and started running with it. The thing was, when I went to this rehabilitation center, I was around nothing but a lot of white kids. And the thing where they were all younger than I was. And I remember on Saturdays, they would play all these great rock and roll records. The thing was, I was doing R&B, remember. But the ZZ Tops and the Rod Stewarts and the Rolling Stones and all those people, I was busy using drugs. I wasn't there when Woodstock. I was there in New York when Woodstock was going on, but I didn't want to go to Woodstock. I would rather go to Harlem, you know. And when I was in the program on Saturdays, we'd be cleaning up. They would be playing songs from all these people. And I would say, oh, man, that music is really happening. And then what really made me think it is because my song, I'd Rather Go Blind, they had a version of it by Rod Stewart. And they kept saying, hey, this is the song you wrote. Listen. And I said, all right. And then while I was in that program, they would take me out kind of with support to kind of do little gigs here and there. We went to Africa to do the Black Festival there when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman were supposed to fight. We went to the American Song Festival. And so my therapist, psychologist, was taking me around trying to just, you know, dip me in a little bit mm-hmm. to let me know, you know, this is the business here that you've been in all your life. Now, what's going to be different about this when you come out? What are you going to do different? Because you're going to get thrown right back in there. So we would just do test runs and things.
In 1978, you opened in some cities for the Rolling Stones on their tour. Were the Stones fans of yours?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, when I was in rehab at the same rehab center in the 70s, 74 and 75, I got a letter from Keith Richards that had said to me that they were getting ready to do a tour. You know, they had Tina Turner and they had B.B. King and they had different people on their tour. And they had wanted me on their tour. And the letter that they wrote came to the rehabilitation center and the therapist got the letter. And he called me to his office and read the letter. And the letter said that he said, we would like to have you on tour with us. We love your music. And he says, but what you're doing right now is more important than what we could ever do with you. But we'll be sure to come back and get you when you're ready. And that was really cool. That was when they came back in 78 and kept their word.
Etta James, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Etta James, speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
At last, my love has come along. My lonely days are over. And life is like a song. Oh, yeah, yeah. At last, the skies above are blue.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. And by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine. This week, Time Digital Magazine presents a consumer guide to downloading music and features the music revolution on the Internet. And by Bantam Books, publishers of Victory in Our Schools by Major General John Stanford, a book outlining his essentials for improving our schools. Available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our look at rhythm and blues with Ruth Brown and the late Laverne Baker, who were both big stars at Atlantic Records.
I got up early this morning so I could walk the floor. I got to hit the streets, 'cause there's a wolf outside my door. The bill collector's calling, and my kids need better shoes. Gonna go to church on Sunday, 'cause I got nothing left to lose. And it's a good day. It's a real good day for the blues. It's raining cats and dogs outside, and
I'm looking for a job. The man I work for laid me off. Lord, and I work for him real hard. But I won't let my kids go hungry.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Rhythm and blues singer Ruth Brown was one of Atlantic Records' first hitmakers. In the 50s, she was their most prolific and best-selling performer. She recorded over 80 songs for the label between 1949 and 1962. She later sued the label for royalties. Her best-known records include Teardrops from My Eyes, 5-10-15 Hours, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean, and Lucky Lips. Ruth Brown made a comeback in the 80s when she starred in the Broadway revue Black and Blue, for which she won a Tony Award. She also co-starred in John Waters' film Hairspray as Motormouth Mabel. In 1993, the year she turned 65, she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Her latest album is called A Good Day for the Blues. Terry spoke with her in 1997. Let's open with her 1953 hit, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean.
You started singing in church.
Mm-hmm.
What was the church and what was the music?
Well, I started singing in church not necessarily because that was of my choosing, but that was the rule, you know. My dad, and coming from a Southern family, I don't know. I wouldn't say that because it was a Southern family that was the norm, but I think that practically any R&B artist, the most of us of my ethnic persuasion, started singing in the church. If indeed at all you did have any kind of a talent, the understanding was it was something that was God-given and you had to give that back. And so my father insisted that if I didn't sing in the church, I was not going to sing at all.
So what kind of singing did you do in church?
Well, I was sort of twisted between my father's church was Methodist, and they have sort of just flat-footed inspirational spirituals, I call it. You know, His Eyes on the Sparrow and Precious Lord and those things. That was in my father's church. Very little exaltations that were visible. I mean, people just didn't jump up and down and shout and show their joy in the Methodist church. But now, on the other hand, in the summer when I went to North Carolina, which where my mother's people were, to work and sharecrop in the fields in the summer, we went to a Baptist church. And it was totally different. You know, in the Baptist church, we didn't have the big organ and all of that like we had in the Methodist church. The music was made by patting of the foot, clapping of the hands, and everything was just done with the human voice. And of course it was so joyous. And on the other side, if it wasn't joyous, it was so depressing. You know, there were songs like Sit Down, Sinner, You Better Sit Down. Sit down, sinner, you better sit down. You ain't going to heaven, so you better sit down. If that didn't take your spirit away, nothing did, you know.
Another exposure to music you had was when you were in North Carolina for the summers, working in the cotton fields. A lot of people sang and shouted there. Sing me some of the things you heard in the cotton fields.
Oh, my goodness. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, and oh, Lord, have mercy on me. Oh, Lord, have mercy on me.
Oh, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy on me. When the world's on fire. When the world's on fire. When the world's on fire. Lord, have mercy. Mercy on me.
You won one of the amateur nights at the Apollo sessions in, I guess it was the late 1940s.
Yes.
And then must have been 1948 or 49, Atlantic Records wanted to sign you. And they were going to bring you up north again, this time for a paid date at the Apollo.
Yes.
What happened to you when you were driving up north to play the Apollo?
Well, we were due to be at the Apollo that Thursday for a 3 o'clock in the afternoon rehearsal, which was what they did. And you rehearsed downstairs in a little place under the main theater. And we left Washington, D.C. En route to New York to be there in time for that rehearsal. And I would assume it was about, I guess, 8:45 in the morning of October 29th. I remember it well, outside of Chester, Pennsylvania. I'm still not sure what happened. Maybe the gentleman driving might have gone to sleep at the wheel. I don't know. All I know is that I remember a screeching of tires, and I remember a crash, you know, and I remember then finally hearing somebody say, the girl in the back is dead, and that they were talking about me. And they took everybody else out before they did me. And finally, when they came to move me, when they went to straighten my leg, my left leg had been broken 3 or 4 places and was back up under my body. They tried to straighten me out to pick me up, and that's when I screamed. And they realized that I was indeed not dead, just in a state of shock.
You were unable to talk until then?
Yes, I couldn't speak. I couldn't speak, whatever the reasons, and my vision, because the suitcase had fallen and hit me in the face and in the head. But I did end up in Chester Hospital and was there for 11 months and something. And once I was released after that period, in fact, my contract with Atlantic was signed while I was a patient in the hospital. They came over for my 20th birthday. And brought the contracts, and I signed them on my bed.
When you became a rhythm and blues star, you toured with some of the rhythm and blues and rock and roll shows. And I'm wondering if you could give us a taste of what it was like for you as a performer to be in those rock and roll shows.
Well, it was wonderful, but of course, they came along a little later. I think they started, there was a father and son team out of West Virginia, who booked all those shows, called the Super Shows. The Weinbergs were the promoters, and they put these shows together. They had this brilliant idea. And at one time, there were people on the bus like the Clovers, the Drifters, the Five Keys, Lester Young, Buddy Johnson's orchestra, Ella Johnson. And then you would have like a Sam Cooke, you know, and you would have a John Coltrane, and you would have Paul Huckabuck Williams and Charles Brown and Roy Brown. And sometimes there were about 10 acts on one bill, and the ticket only cost about $7.50, you know.
Was there ever a point during your adult life when you couldn't earn a living singing and you had to do other jobs?
Oh, yes, of course.
What did you
do? Of course. I did domestic work. I drove a school bus.
You did domestic work after you had rhythm and blues hits?
Oh, sure. This was during the 60s, you know.
Well, how did you feel after the adulation that you'd get on stage cleaning other people's houses?
Well, I didn't feel anything about it because what I was doing was earning a living, a clean, decent living. And it was what my mother had done all of her life, so I felt no shame about it because I did that with as much dignity as I do anything else. I did a good job. I was a good housekeeper, you know? And it wasn't until my needs were of such that I was cleaning house one day and I heard my music. I heard a disc jockey talking about my greatness and how great Ruth Brown was, and at that time I think I was scrubbing a floor. And that is when I sort of made up my mind that there was some money that belonged to me that I had not been receiving. You know, I had not gotten a royalty statement in almost 30 years. I hadn't seen one, you know. And my records were being sold all over the country, and he was talking about how big this was in Japan and in Germany, and I had no idea about this. So I began this battle, this uphill battle it was, to maintain and reclaim something that was really mine. I refused to beg because I was going to fight for I knew what was mine. You know, if these records are being sold, then I'm entitled to my part of whatever they're being sold for.
You sued your first record company. What was the outcome
of
the suit?
My first and only one. I sued them. I fought them for 11 years. I fought 11 years for royalty reform. I fought with a young lawyer out of Washington, a young man who walked up to me one day with some Ruth Brown records under his arm, and I asked him where he got them, and he told me how he paid for them. We struck up a conversation. He became my best friend and worked. We fought almost 11 years to get record reform, which we did, and I finally... Now, after all these years, I'm getting record royalties back again for the first time in many, many years, you know.
Ruth Brown's latest album is A Good Day for the Blues. She'll be at the Monterey Jazz Festival on September 18th. This is Fresh Air. Laverne Baker was one of the rhythm and blues stars of the 50s and early 60s. She died in 1997. Terry Gross spoke with her in 1991, the year she was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. With hits in the 50s like Jim Dandy, Bumblebee, and Tweedledee-Dee, Laverne Baker was another one of Atlantic Records' first big success stories. During most of the 70s and 80s, she lived in the Philippines, where she ran a nightclub in Subic Bay. Her career was revived in 1988 when she performed at a 40th anniversary concert for Atlantic at Madison Square Garden. That led her to Broadway, where she appeared in the R&B revue Black and Blue, and that led to her return to the recording studio. Let's go back to the 50s and hear her novelty hit, Bumblebee.
Shut up.
Evil bumblebee. I gave you love as sweet as honey. My life, my soul, and all my money. You didn't seem to realize you had a home in paradise.
Shooey, you hurt me like a bee.
A bumblebee, an evil bumblebee. Don't you know I cry? Just one kiss before you go. Don't ever come back no more. Now, baby, there's no need of crying. I'm sick and tired.
So my guest Laverne Baker is recorded in 1960. Now, Laverne Baker, you were born in Chicago, and you started performing in your teens.
Yes.
And when you started performing in clubs around Chicago, you were known as Little Miss Sharecropper. Who gave you that name?
Regretfully, yes. Some guy. Well, it was a long story. It's like at the big club, De Lisa, which was the place during those early 40s, 50s in Chicago. And they had a singer there named Little Miss Cornshuck. And she was a great singer. And she used to come out with a little, like, Bo Peep outfit on, with a little basket and mm-hmm. ribbons in her hair. And she was, oh, quite famous. Her name was the Talk of Chicago. And she got on the wrong path, you know, and wasn't able to perform. So then they were looking for someone to take her place. So I met this guy at another one of our big clubs. I had went to see the show, and I did a guest number. And he said, you know, they're looking for a good singer at Club Delisa. So I was a little nervous to go to the breakfast dance because I didn't have no business out that, you know, all night long at that during those years, you know, because the breakfast dance started at 6 o'clock in the morning. But I slipped and went anyway, and I got the job. And the next thing I knew, they had put these little costumes and ribbons and baskets in my hand, and they called me Little Miss Sharecropper because they couldn't use corn shuck, you know. And Sharecropper was related to that. But about 2 years after I left, I hurried up and got rid of it. So,
did you protest when they wanted to outfit you that way? And
no,
you
I
that?
Didn't. You know, you got to get your foot in the door before you can say anything in regards to what you do. You know, I wasn't strong. I just wanted to get started, and I didn't care how, you know, as long as it was legit, you know. So they wanted me to sing. And hey, I enjoyed it for a while, you know. But then as I started to mature, you know, and I saw other singers, you know, looking so beautiful on stage, I didn't like it anymore.
Now, I want to read you a review from Variety. And this is from 1954, the year that you signed with Atlantic.
Wow.
And this is a review of you at the Apollo.
Oh, I see.
And the reviewer wrote, "She's a strong-voiced looker who embellishes her singing with movement and suggestiveness worthy of any grind artist. And while this goes well at the Apollo, she'll have to hold back in other situations." weird review, but I was wondering, you know, what were you doing in your act then, and did you have to change what you were doing
in
terms of emotion?
Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yes. When you, well, as you mature, you know, like for one-nighters and the Apollo, that was great, you know?
What were you doing?
I have a thing I do. I turn around and my behind moves, you know, and stuff like that. You know, I still can do it, you know. It's all muscle control type thing, you know. But the audience go crazy when you do this, you know, and the young audiences back then in rock and roll. And at that time, I was not playing sophisticated and big nightclubs. I was doing strictly one-nighters and theaters. So I had to stick to it. But, you know, as I got a little older, I wanted to change, and I did change. And I made it. I went to Basin Street East with Louis Armstrong more than one time, you know. And I played Vegas. And these are rooms and things that I could not get when I was in rock and roll. So I had to change my act, you see.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening to an interview Terry recorded with the late Laverne Baker in 1991. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring a 1991 interview with the late Laverne Baker.
Now, you were one of the first black singers to cross over to a white teenage audience.
Yes.
In the 1950s. Was there a conscious attempt at Atlantic Records to give you certain kind of material or to change your stage act in any way to help you cross over?
No. The music, Atlantic always picked my music, Ahmed and Jerry at the time. They always picked, you know, the songs that they wanted me to sing or they thought that would be best for me. And I never argued at that particular time. I'll fight now, but I didn't argue then. And because they knew what they wanted, you know. But coincidentally, the things that they gave me, I enjoyed doing at that time. So I gave my best at it, you know. And sometimes they would come in the studio and play different things and holler in the background, you know, to make it better, you know, sound like more people.
They'd holler in the background on the record?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which record did they do that on?
Quite a few. They'd sing with at that time we had a group called, a backup group called the Q's. And a lot of things he'd come in and he'd show them, he'd sing with them to show them what he wanted, you see. And this is the way we worked back then, you know. We had a small room and it was like they were on one side and we were on the other, and, you know, and we made millions of hits up there in that little hole that we were in.
Now, I want to play Tweedledee Dee, but, you know, the voices that come in at the beginning,
uh-huh,
they're kind of square-sounding voices, don't you think?
Yes, yeah. These are the cues. And one of the cues is the one that wrote Tweedledee Dee, Mr. Winfield Scott. He's the one that wrote it. And that is the longest recording session I've ever had in my life.
What made it so long?
We did 52 takes.
Whoa, you're kidding.
No, I kid you not.
How come? What went
wrong?
Well,
he wasn't satisfied. It was something missing. And during the break, we know they always give us a little break for tea or whatever to rest our voices, you know. And I did, I was kidding with it, and I said, hump, bump, 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 like that. And Ahmed said, that's it. That's it. That we, that's how that got in there. You know, it was just something missing that he wasn't. And he's like that now, you know. He's like that now. Everybody say he's still the same. If he's in a date and he's not comfortable, you know, he knows what he like, you know. And if he don't hear it, he'll keep pushing, you know. So that's that with the Tweedledee Dee session. It was very, very long.
Well, why don't we listen to Tweedledee Dee? And this is my guest, Laverne Baker.
I'm as happy as can be. Chimney Cricket, Chimney Jack, you make my heart go clickety clack. Tweedledee, Tweedledee, Tweedledee.
This Laverne Baker is recorded in 1955, a song that went up to number 14 on the charts. Big hit for you. Now, how did you feel when you were given the song? Did you like the song?
Yes and no.
What was the yes and what was the no?
Well, because, you know, I told you we did so many takes. And it just didn't make any sense to me, okay? You know, and
but the lyric or the
yeah, the lyric. The music was okay. We had to find the music to really fit it, you know. So I came up with a suggestion of Brazil. If you notice, it's
at the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, dun 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 dun. So you know, and that's why I was so upset when Georgia Gibbs covered my record, because we worked very hard to stay away from the main track of Brazil, just a little taste of it, you know. And then she recorded my song word for word. I was very upset with this because she used my arrangement. Use your own arrangement, you know. That was the only kick, because once the song is PD. Public domain, anybody can sing it, you know. I was really upset with the arrangement because we worked very hard on that.
Georgia Gibbs' cover of your record went up to number 2 on the charts.
I know. It was so many people had they thought they had the original and they didn't. They had hers.
Now, she was a white singer.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Recording your hit.
Yeah.
Were there stations that would play the white singer's version of it that wouldn't play yours?
Oh, yeah. And there were some of them that played hers, and after they found out she wasn't the original, they wouldn't play it anymore. You know, this happened in the whole state of Illinois and Michigan.
Did you play a lot of the rock and roll shows that were put together by Alan Freed and
yes,
Murray
I
McKay?
Did. Yeah.
What was it like to perform with those? Who were some of the people who shared the bill with you? And
so many.
What was it? Yeah.
Oh, so many. I wish I had known you were going to ask me that. Let's see. The last show I did with Free, I think, was at the Brooklyn Paramount. It was Chuck Berry, and I got my eyes closed trying to remember this. It was Chuck Berry, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, the Everly Brothers, Paul Anka, Screaming Jay Hawkins, Bill Doggett. Oh, quite a few. I can't remember them all.
What a show.
Yeah, he used to carry, we had two busloads full to capacity and maybe four cars all the time.
In the 1950s, you recorded an entire album of Bessie Smith songs.
Oh, I loved it. Now, that's a recording date I enjoyed. I really did enjoy it. I loved the songs. And after I listened to Bessie Smith, and even now that I'm older, and when I do her numbers, I sound more like her, you know. I was told that by the bass player and some of the guys who actually worked with Bessie Smith that was still living, Atlantic got some of the original guys that played with her. You know, and they told me, said, man, you really sound like Bessie. You know, I just had one of those big growling voices, I guess.
25 cents, no, honey. I wouldn't pay 25 cents to go in nowhere. Listen here. Up in Harlem every Saturday night, when the highbrows get together, it's just too tight. They all congregate at the all-night strut. And what they do is a tut, tut, tut. Old Hannah Brown from Waycross Town gets full of corn and starts breaking them down. Just at the break of day, you can hear old Hannah say, give me a Bigfoot, yeah, and a bottle of beer. Send me gate, I don't care. I feel just like I want a clown. Give the piano player a drink because he's bringing down. He's got a rhythm, yeah! When he stomps his feet, he sends me right off to sleep. Check all your razors and your guns. We're gonna be resting when the wagon come. I want a Bigfoot, oh, and a bottle of beer. Send me because I don't care. Stay because I don't care.
Laverne Baker's recording of the Bessie Smith song, Gimme a Pigfoot. Laverne Baker spoke with Terry Gross in 1991. She died in 1997. Today's Blues Week edition was produced by Phyllis Myers. And today we say thanks and good luck to our jack-of-all-trades producer, Kathy Wolf, who's leaving Fresh Air to complete her master's degree as a family nurse practitioner and who expertly assisted in the birth of my daughter. We'll miss you, but we know that your future patients will be glad you're looking after them. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publishers of Legacy, a biography of Moses and Walter Annenberg by Christopher Ogden, in hardcover wherever books are sold. And from Petopia.com, offering food, advice, toys, treats, and supplies delivered to pets and their people nationwide. On the web at Petopia.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we conclude Blues Week with the man Eric Clapton called the best guitarist alive, blues guitarist Buddy Guy. And we'll hear a performance with Rufus Thomas from the 1997 Chicago Blues Festival. Join us for the next Fresh Air.